Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, policy and science, advocacy and activism. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and what's going on in our total health environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the ecological balance and stability of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different experts, thought leaders, authors, scientists, doctors, filmmakers, advocates, poets, a whole range of people about all of the different things going on in our complex and interrelated world that connect to us and our health, as well as connect us to each other and to the caring and compassion that we need to make it through and create a pro-health and caring and compassionate society in challenging times like these. That's what we discuss each day on the show. I also want to highlight that this week, as you're listening to this particular show, I have an article which is up on both Alternet and EcoWatch about some upcoming threats that are happening to the continuation of organic foods and the organic food label. As you listen to the show today, there's an important meeting happening at the National Organic Standards Board, or NOSB. This is under the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, and right now, organic consumer advocates along with organic industry leaders are considering an important question that really has a lot of future impact on the continuation and integrity of our food supply and on organics. So I urge you to go to either Alternet or EcoWatch, where I have current articles up about this, as well as pay attention to upcoming coverage of the way the vote goes. There's a debate going on between organic earth-grown foods grown in soil as part of our natural environment that nourish us with the earth-derived nutrients versus the upcoming and surging hydroponic industry, which grows food in water of lesser nutrient value and lower cost that in effect threatens the organic farming and the organic label that it's taken us 17 years to build. Just an alert to pay attention to that. And we'll be also mentioning that a little throughout the show as well as it's relevant to today's topic. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my guest for today. He's a repeat guest on our show with a terrific new book, Dr. Joel Fuhrman, MD. Dr. Fuhrman specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. He's the president of the Nutritional Research Foundation, and the new book that we're going to be talking about today is extraordinarily well-researched and well-synthesized in pulling together the different research that exists on the important topic we'll be talking about today. He is also the author of several books, including several New York Times bestsellers, Eat to Live, Eat to Live Cookbook, Super Immunity, The End of Diabetes, and The End of Heart Disease. And he'll be offering some terrific prescriptions today in his latest book, which we're going to be talking about today, which is called Fast Food Genocide. I don't think that overstates the case, and he certainly documents that assertion throughout this terrific book. The subtitle is How Processed Food is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. And it's really interesting because I have an article up on Alternet today about preserving the healthy food supply with the very kinds of important nutrients and minerals and everything that we need, preserving that corner of the food supply that is healthy, unprocessed, and free of pesticides, namely organic food, which is under threat this very week as we are talking from a prospective vote at the National Organic Standards Board, which is happening right as we listen to the show today. And I have an article up on Alternet about what we need to do to protect the healthy food supply. Listeners interested in these topics, may want to check that out. And now let's jump in and talk about fast food genocide. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Joel Furman.
Thank you, Allison. Great to be here.
You know, this book is such a compendium of important information. And, you know, one of the, I'm just going to sort of jump right in, because we'll kind of reveal over time the kind of diet that you have consistently recommended throughout your books and are recommending in this book, as well as the research supporting that. But what makes this book really interesting is the strong case you make for what happens to people when they eat what is regarded as the typical normal American diet. And, you know, there are disease impacts, which you recount in this book. You know, one of the things that I think is fascinating, given some of the negative directions that I say our overall society is going in, is the chapter you have about our brains on fast food. In other words, what actually happens to our thinking, our caring, our social capacities, our capacities to lead our lives? You know, how can actually our ability to function, think clearly, care, function neurologically, be impacted by our food consumption when we're eating unhealthy fast foods versus healthier foods?
That's the huge point of the book is what you're making right now, and what I wanted to get across is because I know a lot of people listening to this show probably recognize that eating junk food and candy and soda and cookie and crackers and breakfast bars and chips and, you know, and fried foods. I think they know that it's a link between those foods and obesity and diabetes and heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. But the brain is ignored. It's like they don't realize the brain is an organ that's deteriorating. You can't have heart disease without damaging the brain. You can't have cancer without having damaged the brain with the same foods. In other words, these foods are damaging the brain, and even moderate use damages the brain. It's so the brain is even one of the most fragile organs in the body that's damaged by these synthetic ingredients and concentrated calories and high sugar intake flux into the bloodstream. The brain is very, very sensitive. So, number one, in the areas of the country where they're eating more fast food, and some of those areas are called food deserts in urban areas, we see 7 times the risk of early life stroke, number one. And that's before age 45, early life stroke before age 45, putting people into nursing homes in their 30s and 40s and 50s, destroying families. And then the link between fast food and depression is affecting all ages, including children. And depression is now the number one cause of disability in America. And the combination between being depressed and having learning and attention deficits as well, they come along with each other. And this negative impact of having our emotions, no excitement, no creativity, no emotional happiness, putting a down on everything we do, destroying our ambition and ability to succeed in life, and then putting people on drugs, either for attention, learning drugs, or drugs for depression or anxiety. Our whole population is being put on medications because we're damaging our brain with fast foods. And nobody's even discussing that food is the cause of all this. It's not a drug deficiency problem. The food is the basic cause of this, and it's destroying the brains of our population. And brain cells are being destroyed all through life, leading to demented, emotionally flat people in their later years. So if they are living, you know, a little bit longer, or they're still alive, they don't have a quality of life because they don't have their full mental faculties. So we're talking here about...
Can I ask you a question, Dr. Furman? How many...
Yes.
What percentage of the population is actually depressed? Because I, you know, in the condition of depression, you not only can't function well for your normal life or in your personal interactions, but, you know, I cover the policy realm and how our health and the environment and food are affected by the choices we make in public policy. And if we have a disinterested population that is, you know, uninspired by the choices before them, but not stepping up to do anything about it, disengaged, you know, whatever, then we don't have a functional citizenry to actually then make the right choices that actually promote health. And that's one of my big topics and concerns. I mean, what proportion of the population do you think is actually depressed?
It's actually an amazing percent. You know, it's the number one cause of disability. We're talking here, mental illness hits about 18% of all adult population. 18%, that's a huge amount of people. That's 42.5 million people in America suffer some type of mental illness, mostly depression. And these statistics, so we're talking about 1 in 5 Americans suffer from mental illness. And the point I'm making, too, is those of us who are not depressed are still affected negatively emotionally. They have a flat affect. They're increased losing their ability to learn and to maintain memory and recall and cognitive function and mathematical skills. And we're still lowering our ability to do well in school and to perform well on our jobs, even when we don't have a major depressive disorder. So even though it's affecting about 1 in 5 people, this permeates our society in such a deep level. And the primary causative factor is nutrition. It's not just luck. It doesn't come out of the air. It's not genetics. It's what we're eating.
That's huge, because that's
huge,
really turnkey for your ability to do anything else. In other words, if you want to change your diet, if you want to, you know, increase your level of health, and you're depressed, you have a flat affect, you feel like nothing really matters, and I'm just kind of trudging along, you know, I'm sort of in a track, and I have to do this, and, you know, I don't have anything left over for myself or for any of this, then, you know, you can be exhorted all day long, but it's going to be extremely hard for such people to be motivated, so it becomes like a vicious cycle that they can't get out of, right?
That's exactly right. The foods are addicting. They take over the brain. They make you overweight. They make you unable to stop eating and control your caloric intake. Mental illness due to fast food consumption costs our country $200 billion just in lost earnings alone from people unable to work, let alone the hospitalizations and the health care costs due to all this fast food, which is ruining our economy. We have a health care crisis that can't be solved in Washington and never can be solved because the costs are too high. And we can't, it's not about who pays for it. Somebody's got to pay for it. It's that there's no way we can afford so many sick people. The only way we can solve our healthcare crisis and the problem with business is also, it's not about passing different laws. It's about, well, there's so many sick people, you can't afford to, your businesses can't afford the healthcare costs involved. And there's so many people out of work and depressed and mentally ill and can't concentrate on their jobs. And the point is that we have a diabetic crisis that costs about $10,000 more per year per person, and diabetes is totally related to fast food consumption and what people are eating, and can be wiped out, and the mental illness can be wiped out. And one thing, we're talking about the monetary effect and how this permeates society. On the other hand, we're talking about millions of people with tragedies befalling them, leg amputations, needing dialysis, be put in nursing homes, suicides. You know, we're talking about tragedies that don't have to occur. We're talking about, this is on a human level, the amount of human suffering involved here is simply enormous, and nobody's tracking this back to the root cause, which is what we're putting in our mouth.
Let's talk a little bit about those choices, because I think Progressive Radio is Gary Knowles' network. He's a longstanding health journalist, as I am. I'm sort of, in that. And yet the actual network has shows on a wide variety of different things that cover, which do, in effect, what my show does, which is cover different facets of all the things that are affecting us nowadays. But,
right.
One of the things we talk about a lot is, a lot of the books like yours and Mark Hyman's and, the other doctors we know who've been, spending 20, 30 years, addressing the situation and trying, and it has been effective for a certain portion of the population that understands these things, has the wherewithal to track down that food. One of the reasons in my current article that I am, vociferously defending, the organic food supply from a corporate takeover and weakening of its integrity is because we need these healthy foods. And the portion of the population that has been motivated, that has been seeking them out, we're preserving the standards, we preserve our ability to access those foods. But we also know that there's a large portion of the population that cannot afford them, that, they're not offered in all places and all times and all neighborhoods. So personally exhorting people to change your diet is less easy for certain segments of the society, and that's something that we don't, you know, often talk about. We just kind of presume that we all have the same choice and the same access to healthy foods. But, you know, you take that on in the book as well, that not everyone can easily escape this cycle and get access to the healthier foods that, you know, you recommend. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Well, yes, and that's where I'm discussing in the book how food inequality and food distribution and food leads to racism, bigotry, and enhances this genocide. The fast food genocide enhances it on particularly vulnerable populations living in urban areas that we call food deserts, where produce is not available, where the severity is not really fully considered by most Americans. For example, that the diabetics and obesity and diabetes resulting from fast food in inner city area, when we track this areas where have the convenience stores and the fast food restaurants are the almost sole source of food supply in those areas, and we track that by the distance to the nearest supermarket and how easy it is to access a supermarket where they sell any vegetables or cabbage or beans or things like that that wouldn't be in a convenience store. And we find that where the access is lowest, we have years of potential life lost, YPLL, years of potential life lost, tracked by scientists as much as 45 years lost, potential life lost from diabetics and obese people living in these areas and whose diseases are caused by their food supply. And, you know, put this into context or put this into in the same, you know, the ivory towers and medical schools teaching science today, you know, are teaching us that Black Americans have higher risk of obesity, diabetes, leg amputations, blindness, and prostate, breast cancer, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's not true. That's not true at all, because if you track it by food access and food consumption, you find that it's not based on skin color. It's based on what's being fed, what's available in a certain population. We go to areas that are occupied by predominantly white populations who have just as bad food access and whose diets are the same, we also see the same outcomes with regard to crime and disease and obesity and depression. So skin color no longer becomes the big issue when we control for what the people are eating and what the food is available in their environment. What I'm saying right now is that we use these statistics, and even medical school, we're taught incorrectly that it's like a form of racism. Because I even tracked the food intake back to the Civil War. When the Black Americans were freed from slavery, they had better access to vegetables, and they had more centenarians, more people living to be 100 years old, better health than white Americans. And then we had pellagra, which was a niacin deficiency disease through the South, which was formed by the corn and molasses and pork diet they had back then, not without enough vegetables in a lot of the white population. And the medical authorities then were denying it was a nutritional disease. They said it was not nutritional. They considered it a disease of genetics in the whites, causing these issues with homicidal and suicidal and violent behaviors, and it caused a redneck that's where the original term rednecks came from, the white population. Even then, that was bad. We didn't even learn from history. That was blamed on the white population, and again, it wasn't due to the color of their skin. It was due to the niacin deficiency in the diet, which they didn't really discover until like 1915, when they started realizing that niacin deficiency was causing mental illness and degeneration of the white population. So we're doing the same thing all over again. We're basing it on individual populations and grouping people together and not recognizing that it's about food and nutrition. And of course, yeah, as Americans, so many of us, and you know, that we're all grouped together under this foundation of wanting equality, wanting opportunity for everybody, wanting to elevate our neighbors and our friends of all color and all, you know, all backgrounds, that were to reach the American dream. And the only way we can achieve this and really achieve the whole foundation of our country, to give everybody this opportunity to succeed, is by giving people the understanding and knowledge about good nutrition, to be the make these foods affordable. And because right now we subsidize junk food, and we don't, you know, so we're paying to make the junk food cheaper, and the vegetables more expensive, but in any case, and of course access, that everybody has the right to have access to healthy food. And when the when populations are made aware, when the education does go to them, when the availability of supermarkets when they are built in the areas, we see health improves, we see people change their life, their life's destiny. And in other words, the solution that I've given in the book and the solution that has been already been started to be incorporated in some areas, it works. People, their health turns around and we see tremendous benefits to society occurring.
You know, this makes so much sense, and I would also guess that we're seeing a rise in bigotry, a rise in kind of hateful speech and hostility, divides among different social groups. I would guess that even portions, and you can tell me maybe I'm off base here, but I would imagine that even portions of the white population who are evincing behavior that some of us might consider in the realm of mental illness. Or certainly antisocial traits of various kinds and larger groups of people expressing such traits and all. I mean, not anywhere near the majority, still a minority, thankfully. But do you think there's any contributing factor from this unhealthy fast food diet that we're talking about to those kinds of presentations? I mean, we think of them purely as political. But, there is a health potentially and definitely a mental health component to that.
That's exactly true. You know, in other words, that I showed in the book the studies that document anger and violence are perpetuated by these type of diets in all populations around the world. So it perpetuates violence, makes people not patient, unable to concentrate on tasks and to actually defer satisfaction, and they want immediate gratification. And the link between crime and drug use and fast food is better than the link between crime and drug use and lack of parents, living in an orphanage, bad parenting, social deprivation, being living in poverty. The link between candy consumption and fast food consumption and these outcomes you're talking about are more robust than almost any other link. So it's affecting our population at a lot of different levels, and it accelerates this chasm between people, this divisiveness between individuals and anger. And of course, On the other hand, when people work collectively to have goodwill for others, when we go together, when we band together to work to elevate the benefits to other individuals, we show through social energy how that's healing to the brain, and it actually restores broken neural pathways in the brain, and how good it is for your, in the most selfish way, how good it is for your own mental health to do things to benefit humanity and benefit other people. So it's all intertwined with food. For good food, nutrients for the brain, antioxidant phytochemicals, and trying to elevate the well-being of the other Americans are the best way we can protect our own brains and our own health. This is healthy stuff for us emotionally and physically. You can't separate emotional health from physical health. They're intertwined like fibers of the cloth, and nutrition and mental health and your direction and where you and what you do with your life are all intertwined in such a profound way. So, and I want to say too that, I know in medical schools in the ivory towers of some of these of graduate programs, they tell us that these inner city urban populations, especially black populations, if you give them that food and you distribute the healthy food, they're not going to eat it. They'll still eat it. They're addicted to the junk food. And sure, the junk food is addicted, but that's also not true. Because when we actually go there and we bring healthy food is brought and you explain to them the problem, they can see the people suffering around them. They can see people having diabetes and leg amputations. They're hungry for this information. And where we have made the effort to educate and teach them how food can taste delicious and how important it is to eat healthy food, people band together for good purposes and they take advantage of this information and they try to better their own outcomes in their own communities. So what I'm saying is this, even though we're talking about the negative effects of all this, there's tremendous hope and there's tremendous ability for people to learn and to change the way we've been going. And also, this healthy stuff can be made to taste great. And that's one of my specialties over the last 30 years, showing people that we can make unbelievably delicious stuff, food, out of healthy ingredients that's good for the brain.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Because I just have to say, I'm just going to throw in an aside here because, writing about health and food brought me to writing about experiment. But if I had a single thing that I could wave a magic wand and change, you know, like that I have always sought to change from day one and, you know, would like to see happen in our society, it's for everyone to have access to health and food and for the subsidies and all of that to go in the right direction and promote a healthy food supply. I've always felt that in the interest of caring, fairness, and as a single intervention that would make the greatest possible social shift, you know, that would be absolutely the best thing we can do. And I, you know, it's always there as a core goal behind everything else I do. And, you know, it's really funny because, you know, I think we may have mentioned this the last time you were on the show, but we are actually second cousins, you know. So it's kind of something about also that is really interesting that we both, you know, in different ways, in different paths, not really being brought up in the same social environment, maybe it's something genetic or something, but, you know, have this shared goal. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm just like utterly fascinated to realize that amazing, you know, through this book, you know, Fast as Genocide, the amazing steps that you have taken to, you know, to help our society move in that direction. Because I honestly share your belief that it's, you know, if we had to do one thing, that would be like, if we did that, I mean, you know, right now in the middle of the health community, I might want to feel that people should be, you know, overspending and under-supported in having necessary health care. But at the same time, if there's one lesson from being part of the, you know, what I consider the proactive health revolution, you know, for the last 25 years myself, it's that we can prevent these things rather than having to deal with them at the level of all of the diseases and symptoms that unfortunately have resulted from not providing healthy resources for everybody and that, you know, are raising all these costs to the point that we're now, you know, having a huge fight. It's bankrupting the economy, and we have a political divide over these issues. You know, had we, if we only kind of start directing the energy in the right direction, we could go very far to solve these problems. I mean, how do you see, you know, the potential? Like, what could we, like, what can we do about the food subsidies, for example? You know, the part in its early years, what I consider, you know, the integrative health and the healthy food movement have, you know, kind of shown what, you know, have followed leaders like yourself and Mark Hyman and Andrew Weil and others, you know, to say, you know, this is the stuff we can do for individual health, and it's kind of a mass public experiment involving millions of people with a very positive outcome, which is that doing this stuff works. The next phase of it is translating it to the rest of the population that's, you know, struggling, eating these bad foods because they're subsidized and going downhill. What can we do to change that on a social level? Like, what can we do to advance these pro-health and healthy eating values so that everyone can share and participate in them?
Well, that's right. I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars spent by lobbyists and spent by the food industry to perpetuate the status quo. And, of course, the combination between our pharmaceutical industry and our food industry is very powerfully economically to perpetuate a lot of these problems we have. And we're not going to solve our health care crisis in Washington. It can't be solved. We have a growing number of sick people requiring tremendous amounts of invasive and expensive medical care. And the only way to solve that is by improving the health of the population through education and information and food policy change, which is not going to happen. However, you know, what I'm saying here is that, you know, they say put the oxygen mask on yourself first, then you can help others. And, you know, we want educators. We want to educate our population, our children and our parents and PTA. We want people to be studying this information. We want politicians to know about it. We want celebrities to know about what could be done. We want athletes to be, you know, aware of this. I think the first step is awareness, and when there's a groundswell of public desire to change things, the change occurs. And I think that the first thing has to happen is a greater awareness, and everybody has to change the way they eat, because then you're spending your dollar, your economic dollar, using that power to pay for things that are healthy, and then fast food restaurants will start carrying beans, chilies, and things like that. Instead of, they put something healthy on their menu, nobody eats it, they take it off the menu and they put back the fried foods there. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Yeah, and then people don't realize the danger. They think, you know, they're listening to this show and they're saying, you know, oh yeah, but you know, those foods are not good, but it's in moderation. You know, it's obviously everything in moderation. I'm also not going to take away my enjoyment in life just to live a couple of years longer. You know, that people have these rationalizations that are actually incorrect and illogical to justify their addictions. The facts state otherwise. In other words, the French fries in fast food restaurants, and also the barbecue and the grills and the high flame broiled meats are so dangerous that the World Health Organization has classified them a type 1, a class 1 carcinogen, in the same category as asbestos. That's how cancer-causing these foods are, so much that one serving of commercial French fries a week increases risk of breast cancer and prostate cancer by over 25%. So we're talking about exceedingly dangerous foods that even in moderate amounts are very dangerous. So I think that, you know, if we get a buy-in by large segments of the population, you know how effective it is when a celebrity or an athlete or, you know, we can affect political change. All we have to do is have this issue be more, people be aware of this issue and realize how critically important it is, and things can change. Because in New York City, the work Mayor Bloomberg did tremendously changed New York City. Remember that when he said that we were going to put a tax, or not going to allow those giant drinks of soda. If you wanted to drink soda, it had to be in a smaller cup, right? And then the legislature didn't pass it. But all the publicity about the soda caused soda consumption to go down by 40% and lifespan of New Yorkers to increase by almost 2 years. We're talking here about even his failed legislature's attempt brought this awareness of food safety, and then he made it so food stamps were able to be utilized in vendor carts for fruits and vegetables, and they were able to get more fruit and vegetable value from their food stamps than they could by combining junk food. And then that had a tremendous effect on food availability and distribution into poor areas of New York. And the results were extreme benefits with less crime, less disease, less hospitalizations. You know, so we're seeing that that even one man like Mayor Bloomberg had such a powerful effect on saving lives there. And it's not even appreciated or understood what happened in New York. But what I'm saying is that we can change things, we can make things better, and people can get rid of their food addiction, control their body weight, get off this endless, you know, endless windmill or endless, you know, wheel of constantly turning wheel of obesity, diabetes, blindness, kidney damage, leg amputation, dementia that's happening in these areas. That it's hard to get rid of an addiction, but with the right information, people can change their way, their pattern of eating. They can reverse their diabetes. They can lose the weight. They can get rid of their heart disease. They can get rid of their depression, and they can improve their quality of their later years. So it's not too late. We can still save millions of lives if people learn this information.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's true. And we're talking about the book Fast Food Genocide by Joel Fuhrman, M.D., just recently published by HarperCollins, or no, by HarperOne, how processed food is killing us and what we can do about it. Let's just talk a little bit about the interaction between what you just were describing as rationalization, which is like when you tell yourself, basically a story about why something is okay, even though you know it isn't, and then addiction, like how the two are different, how they function together, because, you know, a lot of this, I mean, begins with what people kind of feel compelled to do via an addiction, and then, you know, some kind of repetitive behavior that gives them some level of comfort, even if it's kind of harming them in another way. And that's locked in by the stories we tell ourselves about how, you know, what that's doing to us, or why it's okay, or that everyone does it, or I can't do differently because my social group does it, or, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
That's right. The primitive brain comes up with all types of delusional excuses to justify and continue addiction, because addiction is that's the prison. The addiction takes over your reasoning skills, and the drive to get the brain stimulated takes over your conscious brain, becomes secondary to the primitive brain getting what it wants, like a little crying, whining baby. Why? Give me my, you know, it's like you just get what you want. The brain wants what it wants, and that you can't even think straight. And you know, your family doesn't matter, your loved ones don't matter, helping others don't matter. Only supplying your addiction matters. It's the overall driver in all your behaviors is getting that donut, getting that cookie, getting that burger, getting those fries, or getting that soda. The only thing that matters to your life is snorting that cocaine. Everything else comes secondary. And your ability to succeed in life, be happy. But here's the thing, is because you get the high when you eat food and the calories rush in your bloodstream, these synthetic calories rush into the bloodstream, people get a dopamine surge like they snorted cocaine. But then, a couple of hours later, just like you're drinking 10 cups of coffee a day and you stop, the next day you're headachy and you're weak from the coffee withdrawal. Once you're on these fast foods, you're getting the stimulation, you're getting the continual cravings and unrelenting drives to keep eating all the time. But the minute you stop eating, stop overeating, that's when the body most effectively can heal and repair and remove toxins. But the removal of toxins is painful, and it causes shakiness and headaches and fatigue, weakness, itchiness, agitation. And people don't like the way they feel, and they actually mistakenly see those detox symptoms as hunger because eating food relieves them, and they think they need more calories. So they now have to consume an excess amount of calories just to feel okay. So just to feel like their energy is okay, they're not fatigued all the time, they have to overeat calories and be obese or overweight. Whereas when you eat healthfully, and here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the start to get rid of an addiction is to flood the body with healthy foods, because we can't willy-nilly cut back on calories and stop eating these foods because we're going to feel too ill. We have to try or flood our body with a healthy food like vegetables and beans and nuts and, you know, and fresh fruits. We have to put a lot of nutrients in our body because we have to enable the body's detoxification mechanisms, because it's too painful to stop eating these unhealthy foods. And when people don't recognize these addictive withdrawals occurring, they don't know why they can't go work on a diet, can't work for them. No diet's going to work, because it's like trying to tell you to breathe less oxygen, because you're going to be gasping for air in a few minutes. And you're gasping for these foods, and trying, your willpower can't be stronger than the overwhelming illness you feel if you don't constantly overeat food. So we have to reduce people feeling ill, and that's where the eating healthfully comes in. So this is a solution to the addiction as well, you know, what I'm giving people. But on the other hand, we have to understand the addictive nature of these processed foods and how it takes over part of the brain. Otherwise, people are not going to be successful in changing their behavior, improving their diets, losing weight, getting healthy again, or even understand why they can't stop eating food or why they're feeling fatigued. You know, the fatigue is good. In other words, what I'm saying is feeling bad is getting healthier. Because while you're feeling bad, bad stuff is coming out of your body. And feeling good, putting the cocaine in or smoking cigarettes or putting the food back in, is really getting sicker. We don't want to feel good. We want to do the right thing. And that sometimes means we have to feel a little ill for a few days to get off these drugs or to get off the fast food merry-go-round.
That makes complete sense. You know, let's talk a little bit. One of the things that I think is really interesting about this book as well is your critique of the survival of the fittest idea and what the actual interaction is between our innate genetics, the social environment, and our lifestyle, the health we experience, and our relationship to each other and the society and the functioning of the society as a whole. I mean, that's a tall order, but you really really take that one on, and I think it's kind of fascinating and very rare.
Thank you. And it's a very interesting subject, and it's very interesting laid out in the book in a way people can understand it. Of course, it's very complicated, and I'm not going to be able to really deal with it in this time we have left remaining, but we have to say that that social deprivation leads to more propensity to not eat healthy. Then we take, for example, monkeys and we test them. Ones that are socially deprived and made more lonely and less able to interact will use food as a substitute for social engagement and will eat unhealthy. We put the monkeys back in a place where they can have social engagement and be active with other monkeys. They won't eat the unhealthy food anymore. They won't be as dependent on mental stimulation and addictive behaviors as a means of solving their stress. What I'm saying right now is that a lot of things happen, but one thing that we know has a positive effect on human longevity and the positive effect on people's ability to make better food choices is when people band together for good purposes, and people interact in a way that's, quote, you know, that builds social energy. And so social, positive social energy is a positive health force, just like eating a piece of broccoli is. So when you work together in for positive social change or for helping other people, it has a positive effect on your own health and your own longevity and your own brain health. And it all, and what I'm saying is, and we're saying too, is it affects your diet choices, your food choices. That the more socially isolated, the more selfish your behavior is, the more likely you're going to make poor food choices. And food, and so it comes hand in hand. And I think we can use food as a means of directing good social energy and towards helping each other through food access and food generosity. So in any case, yes, it all works together, and as well as animals that overeat shorten their lifespan. And animals that overeat calories, we're saying here it also affects your offspring's health. In other words, it affects your genes when you eat poorly and eat unhealthily. And the genes may be damaged from multiple generations, not just for your children. And so the autism, the growth of autism, the growth of attention disorder, and even childhood cancer and brain tumors occurring in children is all going to get worse, and it has been getting worse and is getting worse as we see this fast food nation continue its not to change its habits. So that's where the genocide comes in. The things are going to be magnified for future generations, leading us to how these food choices and where we've gone has infiltrated all aspects of American society. That, and we can push things, we have to do things the other way, and that's why I'm just so passionate that this information gets known to America, because I really think if it does get known, that collectively we can really do a tremendous, we can help people in a tremendous fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what do you do to solve the food desert problem? I mean, you've educated the people. You know, then what happens next? They kind of go to officials like Mayor Bloomberg or the city council, and they ask for help in bringing food to their neighborhood. Or, you know, like how do you see that knowledge? I mean, you know, they begin to try to seek out healthy foods, but it's kind of hard for people to do in a beset community. Like how do you actually, what do you see the steps that, you know, start with education and then translate into they're having better access to that food, and they're, you know, gaining that access for their community?
That's correct. The political activists, the political activity has to occur along with education, because if the people are, people have to understand that you can't just bring the food there and they don't even know why it's there. They have to know that it benefits them, and they can, you know, so that the people are actually utilizing that food, spending money on it, so the people, so the supermarkets opening up have customers, because the fast food restaurants and the convenience stores are selling food that is so highly addictive. But when that happens, when education is done in conjunction with economic benefits, in other words, they give these supermarkets some economic, you know, tax breaks. They give them some real estate breaks for opening up in the area, which they did in New York City. They've done it in other areas of the country, even in California today. They're giving it's incentives, tax incentives, to certain businesses that distribute healthy food to areas that are healthy food deprived. And when those incentives are given in conjunction with education, we see people taking advantage of it, and health outcomes do change. So it's a combination of factors, like you're saying. We have to educate ourselves. We have to educate our population. We need celebrities, athletes, educators, school systems, and parents involved. And we need politicians involved as well to give incentives for people with businesses to want to open up in these areas, to say, if you open here, well, you're going to be successful. People are going to buy your food. You're going to have a tax break. You're going to have business loans at a favorable rate, and everybody's going to benefit from this. And it works. When we do these things together, it works, and outcomes benefit. And then all across America, as you know, even when there is good supermarket access, we still have fast foods on every street corner. We still have people living on, as the majority of calories consumed in almost every community in America is still coming from processed foods and fast foods. And the healthcare crisis permeates all industries because of that. And by moving to help areas that are more vulnerable and at the same time elevating the health of areas that are less vulnerable, that are, you know, partially or vulnerable or also vulnerable but not quite as bad, then we're going to see a change throughout all of America and all our society, and see tremendous economic benefits occur from a population better educated, more a population that can perform better, that's not going to be depressed, that's not going to have so much disability, that's the medical costs going to drop in half, industry will flourish better, and will be more competitive in the worldwide marketplace, and we'll have a much happier population. So I see tremendous power from this type of movement can have on benefiting all aspects of American society.
Yeah, I wish you would run for office, I'll tell you. I work on that campaign. I think, I really feel like, honestly, I feel like health really, we put money at the top, but I really feel like health should be the preeminent social value. Why are we making choices based on money that then impact health? Whether it's, to profit the people growing, the soy oil and the corn,
right,
and the canola and all of these unhealthy foods, they get to profit. And yet we have this huge price tag, and as well as human and societal damage, that results from this kind of choice. I mean, why isn't health the top choice? We're poisoning people, contaminating.
Because people think health, they think health is giving money to drug companies. They think health will get
right.
More medical care. They think medical care access is going to solve our problem. Give everybody medical access and give them more drugs and more medical visits and more chemotherapy. That's going to help, And they don't realize that, of course. I'm not saying we shouldn't have access to medical care, but I am saying it's not going to solve the problem, because the problem isn't lack of – the problem is too many sick people, and we got to keep – and medical care doesn't make you well. It puts more toxins in you, and some of these drugs cause cancer. Of course, the statin drugs increase risk of breast cancer, the calcium channel blockers, the low blood pressure increase risk of cancer, the diabetic medications often make you gain weight, make you more diabetic. They don't understand that more access to medical care can cause, there's more iatrogenic disease and more disease caused by medical care itself. That's not gonna, we're still not getting to the cause we have to differentiate health care. Health care to most people and politicians means give more money to people who go to doctors and more money to spend on drugs. And it's really not going to solve the issue at all. It's not solving the issue at all. We need food. Food is going to solve the issue. Right.
Yeah. I mean, now we even have like these surgical operations where, people have a portion of their intestine removed, or a kind of a blocker put in so that, that restricts surgically their ability. I mean, and it's people are making money off of that. And then other people feel like, there's no hope for, stemming their weight gain except by undertaking such surgery. I mean, it's actually incredible. It's almost like science fiction.
It's
normal.
Right. More invasive and expensive medical care as a solution to everything that ails us, instead of solving it at the problem at the cause. It's inefficient, it's ineffective, and it's stupid.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, that's exactly right. When you really understand the benefits of addressing it from the front end, then it's so clear that, we've gotten onto this wrong track, and, it builds up certain industries, but our health, the very industries that are being built up, I mean, not all of them are health, obviously the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry are directly, related to the problem because they are pointing us to late-stage solutions rather than the causes, and then they profit from it. But the food industry profits from it. The gas and oil industry profits from contaminating, the earth and communities and people and making people sick. And then that's not regarded. I mean, that's an area that I've covered a great deal. The area of toxicity and consumer and industrial products and initiatives and activities, that area isn't considered to be related to health, but it is very much related to health, in fact, to the health of the population, because it's yet another, source of toxic exposure that's worsening people's health. So we never actually look at the price tag, of making these profitable, so-called profitable for certain sectors, choices over people's health. We just it's kind of mind-boggling. We never really want to look at that. I actually think that it would take a doctor politician, to kind of lead the charge and say we have to put health first. We have to make health the priority of our society. We have to do some reorganization because, going as we are is not only destroying the health of the people, it's harming the earth, which is our basis for being here. We're not living in, a space capsule. We have to rely upon the earth. and it's economically taking down our society. So, you know, this really hasn't worked. You know, we hope it worked. We believed in it. We invested in it. We tried this. It's not working. You know, how do we turn our attention toward, you know, social values that promote health? And I think what you're doing, you know, back to genocide, and again, I'm speaking with Dr. Joel Thurman, MD, is really asking those hard questions and pointing toward the kinds of ways that we really need to intervene. And also, I mean, just, you know, to bring this up, you know, I would say that the discussion that we're having now, if we had it 7 years ago, there'd be a certain portion of the population that has been health aware, health conscious, building their health, motivated to do so, economically positioned to do so, who would know what we're talking about. But a lot of other people would be kind of like, well, it's just my personal health choice, and it doesn't really have the broad systemic effects that you're diagnosing in fast food genocide, you know, and they'd be kind of unaware of them. But I think more and more lately, you know, over the last year or so, people are really able to see that, you know, our society is very troubled. It's not going in a good direction. And, you know, and it's not just because, you know, there may be contributing factors of people who are callous or greedy or even mentally ill, but it's not just you individuals. You know, that are making this problem, it's more of a systemic problem. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I do agree with you here, and I do think I think the hope I have and the optimism I have is realizing that when enough people change, that everybody has plays a role to play, an important role to play. It's not just politicians. It's not just people in positions of power. It's that we all have powerful mm-hmm. positions. Whether we're working at a corner store and we can help, you know, whether we're an educator or a teacher, whether we're teaching our own family, whether we have loved ones, whether we're working in a nursing home, whether we're a physician or a nurse, whether we're, in other words, whether you work in a supermarket, whatever, in other words, I think that as the awareness of this information and permeates our society, and I think that everybody can play a role in helping this information permeate society, like putting on their own oxygen mask. And we think we all have a right to our children who don't want to have to care for us when we're in a nursing home, or care for us when our health is when we're demented and we have no life left because we destroyed our brain with processed foods and the wrong food, not eating the right foods. That even our own families don't deserve for us to put onto them the responsibility of caring for people that are half alive who can't care for themselves anymore because they've depleted their brain with probably lack of nutrients from their diet being so poor. So we have an obligation in our own life to take care of ourselves, for our own health and well-being, for our families, and for our country, and then to reach out and help others. So I think that it's something we all can share in as Americans, and we all can do our small part. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity I've had to have a big effect on so many millions of people. And it's just I can't ever believe that I would have had this opportunity to be able to be given this. This opportunity to be able to have such the effect in my books and my television shows and things. So I'm really grateful for that. On the other hand, all the things other people are doing is very important too. And we're working together on this. It's not like just, you know, we're all working together on this as coming together. And I think if we can get enough of a groundswell of Americans coming together on this issue, we can really change mm-hmm. a lot of the negatives that are happening across our country.
Yeah, that would be really incredible. How is your message received in the healthcare system? How is it received by the kind of, you know, ground level nurses and people who are really, you know, on the front lines of care? How is it received by, you know, the doctors and the academic institutions that are really articulating or dictating the kinds of care that are necessary, you know, in our society? You know, how do you see that now? Has it changed from what it was in the past where, for example, you know, doctors weren't taught at all about nutrition? You know, 15 or 20 years ago, there was no talk about nutrition. There are certain medical directives of the past that actually contributed to the society's kind of going down the wrong road nutritionally. You know, has that changed? Where do you see that today in terms of, you know, the understanding or receptivity to the messages that you're putting out?
Well, it's only changed slightly. You know, there's a slight change. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I speak at medical conferences. I'm asked to speak at grand rounds at hospitals. Doctors who hear this message will get enthusiastic. The American College of Allopathic Medicine's membership has gone up tenfold in the last decade. I mean, so we certainly have a completely different receptive audience today, but it's still very small.
We've been talking with Joel Fuhrman, MD, the author of Fast Food Genocide and a New York Times bestselling author of Eat to Live. Today we've been discussing how processed food is killing us and what we can do about it. As you can see from the conversation that we've had, Dr. Fuhrman is brilliant. His new book on Harper One is destined, I feel, for bestsellerdom, as his previous books have been. Do pick it up because it's an unflinching prescription for resolving our health crisis and moving forward to a pro-health society. It's been a pleasure speaking with Dr. Fuhrman yet again. If you've enjoyed this show, please like us on iTunes and share it with your friends. Dr. Fuhrman has previously also been a guest on this show, and you can look him up in the Connect the Dot archives on connectthedots.podbean.com. And that's where you'll find all our history of shows over the last 7 years. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll be back with another edition of Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Alison Rose Levy. Chin up, keep marching forward, standing tall with all our relations. Have a great week.